Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to the KE Report Weekend Show. Corey Fleck here, your host for this weekend show. It's a packed hour where I am going to be focusing more on really markets broadly. We're going to talk about a lot of different sectors, U.S. equity markets, currencies, and commodities with a couple of my favorite traders, starting off with Rick Bensignor. Rick is the president of Bensignor Investment Strategies, writes the institutional newsletter, Supposedly Irrelevant Factors. That's read by some of the most successful hedge funds in the world. And on the retail and individual side, check out the In The Know Trader website. I'll post a link to that website in the show notes. Rick has two products, a weekly report called the Tactical Trader Report and a daily report called the Daily Tip Sheet. All of these keeping you abreast of where Rick sees opportunities in the markets, in a wide range of markets. Just on another note, be sure to check out our website, podcast, and subscribe to us through your podcast player and on YouTube to keep up to date with all our daily editorials covering daily market moves and company updates. A lot again coming at you this week. Rick, let's start off with U.S. equity markets. Look, Liberation Day, that was the last time we chatted. It was shortly after Liberation Day when the markets went through really a waterfall decline. It hit pretty much every sector and every market. Since that time, this last month, just over a month of trading, has been very strong for markets. The S&P back to pretty much 6,000, all-time high, 6,150. We're so close there. Even the NASDAQ has had a strong rebound. It does seem like a lot of the trade talk has completely changed. Instead of more tariffs, higher tariffs, we're hearing about deals. Whether you like these deals or not, whether there's substance around them, that whole narrative has changed. So, Rick, what's your take on the strength of this rebound, especially in U.S. markets?
Well, it's been a very impressive rally for sure, and we've recouped almost the entire decline. But I got to tell you that right here and right now with spiders in the low 590s, I've actually got a counter trend sell signal right now that at a minimum would suggest it's high risk to first put new capital to work here now on an index level, right? So in S&P 500 terms, buying now comes with more risk than any other time since the lows were made. And that's not just because we happen to be on the highs, but it's because where we are in the scheme of things with the models that I look at and put a lot of credence into. So I'm not buying anything up here. I'm actually been trimming over the last several days. And I don't think from here you really need to risk much more than, 1% or so on that idea. And that doesn't mean if I sold out of a stock today or lightened a long that I had on, that if the S&P moves up 1%, I go replace it and put it right back on. But it says from a risk reward point of view that this isn't the time or place to be buying. And it wouldn't surprise me at all if next week we get a pullback and, we get into, let's say, we fall 15, 20 spider points, that's 150 to 200 S&P points at a minimum, just to kind of correct some of the unyielding strength that we've seen since the lows were put in. And the same type signal that's showing up now to suggest potential upside exhaustion is the same signal that came in one day after the low. So on April 8th, the signal came in that the exact opposite, selling S&Ps under six, spiders under 600 would have come with inordinate risk on the sell side. And that's exactly what we're getting now on the upside and saying that the risk is high to first be a buyer here. So in the grand scheme of things, the lows made hit all the key targets that we had talked about well before they ever got there. And you and I talk about once a month. You and your listeners know that I had long talked about the low 480s for spiders as being the downside target, and the low of the entire move was 481.8. So, a perfect kind of low came exactly from both timing models, measurement models, momentum models, everything that we look at got below, including sentiment, which in S&P futures had fallen to 10% bulls at the low. So, to me, I have said the low was in, the high was in, and I didn't have any particular reason, given the known fundamentals, that we would take out either side of both the high and the low made this year. And obviously, with us trading, S&P, let's call it Spiders 592 right now, we're a heck of a lot closer to potentially making a new high than we are to a new low. But for now, I'm going to kind of stick with that and say we've got the range in, and it's mostly range trading at this point. And unless Spiders got above, I don't know, 615 for a few days or something like that, I think that the high at 613 is a good enough reference level that we don't make any new high by any material way right now. Now, with President Trump being who he is, and how things can change on a dime, that of course can change at any moment. But given the known news that we have, I think this rally is due for a pullback, not enough to go take out the lows. I'm not sure we'd even get an opportunity to fill. There is one unfilled gap on the chart somewhere around 530 or so in Spiders. I don't know if if there'd be enough weakness to get down there. I tend to think not at this point. But objectives were met on the upside. And I started telling your listeners from, I guess it was either summer or early fall last year, that Spiders would top at 609 and then get a minimum double-digit percent decline. And we ended up getting a 20% decline. And I identified 3 weeks before we got there where to do the buying in the low 480s. So we've called the high, we've called the low. And I'm saying right up around here is probably a place to consider putting on a net for those who like to trade a tactical bearish bet, either using options or just shorting Spiders or doing something like that.
It is so crazy to think about the markets at all-time highs in mid to late February dropping to lows from the beginning of 2024, giving up all those 2024 gains just into the beginning of April. And now we're halfway through May, and they have taken back all of those gains from 2024. This is crazy volatility that we are seeing. And I do see a relationship between the S&P and NASDAQ, the tech sector, in terms of the strength. The small caps have really lagged this bounce. What sectors are you seeing as being the strongest out there? Or on the flip side, which ones are the weakest in your eyes?
Well, surprisingly, industrials right now have the best trend for both outperformance and positive momentum. And that's a sector that generally, over time, is nothing more than an equal weight because it's such a diversified sector that as one part does well, another part does not so well, and it tends to even out over time. So you don't generally make a lot of alpha being in industrials, but right now, that is the sector out of the 11 macro sectors that shows the best combination of trend of outperformance and trend of positive momentum. A lot of the cyclical sectors that had been doing well have dramatically lost upside momentum, and some of them have even lost over the last few weeks the ability to outperform. Names like, energy, healthcare, which had done well and now all of a sudden are looking terrible. And obviously something like UnitedHealth has changed the whole healthcare XLV ETF performance. And then let's take a look at what had been prior leaders, which were the three macro sectors that comprise the Mag 7 names, XLK, XLY, XLC, which for those who don't know, that's technology, consumer discretionary, and communication services. Those got slaughtered, and now they are continuously less bad and starting to be, how shall I say, they've reduced their negative bias enough so that all the downside momentum and the underperformance is starting to unwind. So they are at least starting to pick up. So they're getting more towards an improving type situation. But it's a mixed bag. Financials still hang in the air. XLC is the one Mag 7 sector that's doing better than the other two, but it's lost a heck of a lot of upside momentum. And that's Google and Meta. And they've both been, with some negative headlines in the last several weeks. And even that's been a tougher play. Obviously, Tesla and Amazon have done very well. Tesla is now over $100, maybe $120 off of the low of the move. So in percentage terms, it's recouped dramatically well. And so I'm not saying I'd necessarily buy them there, but the Tesla bottom, I believe, is it got down to 220. We're now trading, I don't know, 340 or something like that. That to me has seen the worst that it's going to see. And you want to be a buyer of that. And it looks like Amazon went through also about as bad as it's going to get and has recouped. So I tend to be a buyer of that. And look, do you know a single person who doesn't constantly shop on Amazon? I don't. Everybody, I mean, look at my neighbor's doorsteps every day, and they're just boxes of Amazon stuff all the time.
Well, Rick, I have kids. You don't want to see our doorstep, man. It's
Yeah,
every day.
it's like exactly. So, that I think when you put that together, XLY is a place you do have want to have some exposure to also. But a lot of the prior cyclical leaders have lost their momentum and are actually now not even outperforming.
Interesting. Rick, one other thing that I like to do is look globally as well, because as strong as this rebound has been in the US markets, I've been following European markets very closely because I've been hearing that whole narrative that European markets have lagged so much. In all fairness, their rebound after Liberation Day has actually been stronger than the US markets. What's your takeaway from that environment?
Well, I actually tend to agree, and I am thinking that both. So the proxy I use for European stocks is the ETF with the ticker FEZ, FEZ, like zebra, and that's essentially their Dow Jones 30. It's 50 stocks. It's the Euro 50, the Euro Stoxx 50. It's the best 50 names in Europe, and it has done very well. And it's close to a breakout to, so let me see. Let me just pull this up for a sec. So we are on the yearly highs right now. The all-time high in this name is about 66. This is now at about 55 and a half. And I think if we get above another buck or two higher, this thing's going to move and be a price leader such that Europe can, it doesn't last long, but there are periods of time that Europe can outperform the US. And I think right now is one of those times that we're going to see it.
Okay. Well, interesting. We'll see how long that outperformance could last too. But again, so much of this is correlated and dependent on what goes on the trade front and really how other countries, other investors view the US. Let's also talk bonds because the 10-year, it has rebounded this month, entered the month right around 4.1 to 4.2%. Now it's just under 4.5%. Still, when I look at it, it looks very range bound to me. A whole lot of indecision looks like it's going on within the bond market. What's your takeaway from where rates are going? Where again, this 10-year, it's been stuck in a range for now 2 years.
Yeah, so I concur with you that we are range bound. Mostly, let's just put the bulk of the year between 4.10 and 4.6%. And I think right now that's kind of where things are. And there isn't a heck of a lot to do. This week's high, actually, just from a technical point of view, bumped up and has fallen from the downtrend line from January's high in yields, which was what, about 4.8%? Something like that. And I think we're kind of range bound. One of my institutional clients runs a very substantial fixed income portfolio for a mutual fund. And we're in constant touch. And I'm just telling him it's all kind of range trading. There's no big macro play to put on right now. There are some unfilled gaps on the downside in the US 10-year. One is at about 3.87%, and a few ticks beneath that. And then there's one even lower and under 3.8%. There's nothing on the upside. There's no unfilled gaps on the upside. So there's no particular bias right here, other than a very, very long-term bias that the bull market in bonds that existed from 1980 to 2020 is over, and that yields should probably move higher over time just based upon some type of return to a more doable equilibrium price, which could easily be more towards kind of the, let's call it, I don't know, 5.5 to 6.25% range for the US 10-year. For now, it was in early April where the bonds had a chance to really break in yield terms. The day of or the day after the low, got again one of those counter trend signals, the same thing that's showing up in the spiders now on the upside is yields had it on the downside. And that was the low of the move. And from that low, a week later, we went from, I don't know, what was it? Under four, we got to, I think, 3.9% or so low. And a week later, we were up at 4.6%. So a monster upside yield move. Pull back to about 4.10. And then we've topped again at, I don't know, 4.55 or so, just even yesterday, and have pulled back. I'll tell you that fixed income traders and people, professionals on that side of the market are kind of dumbfounded over what's gone on. And in traditional Wall Street terms, fixed income players are considered the smart money on Wall Street. In other words, the bond market is the smartest market as far as laying out the scenario for the economy, not equity people, but bond people. And if they're confounded, then it kind of begs the question of everything else that relates to where bond prices are and what's going on there. How much of that can one actually trust when the players in the bond market themselves are very unsure of what's going on?
That's a very good point, Rick. Also, I think just crazy to see that these levels, this range that the 10 years trading in, we haven't seen this for 20 years. The last time the 10 years trading in around this level for a prolonged period of time was 20 plus years ago. But Rick, again, globally, the 10 year paying out in the US, let's say 4.5%-ish. Globally, that's pretty high. How do you see the rest of the world looking at the US bond market right now? As again, kind of with that trade away from American narrative, we heard that other countries were selling down their bonds. There wasn't going to be that support from international investors.
Yeah, well, but when think about Corey, when was the talk of that at its height?
It
Early
was
April.
Liberation Day. Yep.
Yep. So we've got higher yields in both relative terms to other places, which definitely keeps money in the US because they want that yield. The dollar broke down and then came right back. And if it's this is really something. If you pull up a weekly chart of the US dollar index, the false breakout to the upside went about, I don't know, 200 pips. Or 2 full points in the dollar index above what had been a range trading for a couple of years, broke out to the upside earlier this year. And then, of course, everything faded. And then it broke back into the range. And then it broke under 199 to do the exact same, approximately 2 point move beneath what had been the lows of the range, only to come right back into it now. So the dollar still holds up. It's not as good as it was earlier this year, but it's still hanging in there. And this also means that both rates and the dollar are higher than where the president of the United States wants them to be. And he, of course, Trump has been pressuring Fed Chair Powell to lower rates. I am very glad that Powell has has kept to not doing anything. I think it's a dangerous move to lower rates because of pressure as compared to what the economy needs. And I think if the Fed were to lower rates with the economy growing the way it is, it would really be problematic, and rates would the rate structure would change all for the worse. So you've got a market that, you know, the dollar is still range bound with a false breakout and a false breakdown, and now towards the lower end of the range, but still within the range. Yields are in the range. The only thing that really has, you know, seen a huge change is the stock market. But as of now, even the S&Ps still are within the range, meaning they haven't made new highs. So, you know, it could end up being that 2025 is the pause year in lots of markets.
When you say pause, do you mean pause and reversal from the trend?
Pause in what the prior trend had been.
But then
doesn't mean
what's
you have
the
to
next
kill.
Trend?
That's the question. You know, some people on business TV are saying that stocks are going to fall to new lows, and the April low is gonna fall and be taken out. On my work, I have nothing that says that has to happen, because all the objectives that I was looking for in the decline were all met. So there's nothing to me that says we have to take out that low. At the same time, we don't have to make any material new high. You want to make a slight trading high to wash out some shorts that, you know, or literally would stop themselves out above 613, you might do that. But I don't see the reason why the call from many people is that stocks need to make a new low. And some of these people making those calls are people I personally trained, hired on Wall Street and trained. I don't see it. I'm not saying it can't happen, but with the spider sitting at 590, to say that the April lows are going to be taken out, and that this is just, you know, a wicked rally, is, I think, more guesswork, and, you know, possibly makes for more for good TV, or hey, let's be different, than it is based on sound reasoning.
Well, that's it. Has it become too trendy to jump on the negative side of the markets?
You've got a fair amount of big money, famous Wall Street hedge fund people saying that the market's going to implode. You've got some technicians saying that this rally isn't going to last, except they also said that, you know, 500 S&P points ago. And in fact, we're never bullish other than right near the lows for a quick bounce. But by the time we got back to 550, we're already negative. My directive to clients was to reduce a little in the, I think it was the 560s, to take some trading profits because we had bought the low and the secondary test, but that there's only one and only one place to consider shorting, and that was Spider's 584 to 589, and we're slightly above that. Today's an expiration Friday. Today we get the counter trend signal. I'm willing to hold that a few more days. If we lose money, we lose 1%. If we're right, we'll make 2 to 3%, if not more. I think, you know, if from a risk reward point of view, that's a good trade. The bigger call to say that this is a vicious bear market rally, well, yeah, it's been vicious. And I think most of these people are underperforming this year and have not figured out what's actually going on. And surprisingly, the one group of investors who almost always gets it wrong, this time got it right, which is the retail investor. Hedge funds were the ones selling in April and pushing to the downside. And the retail public was buying. And they've been right, because look at where we are relative to the all-time high. We're only a few percent away, right? What are we, 4%, 4.5%, something like that from the all-time high? Retail got this one right. They rarely do when you have such big moves in such a short amount of time. but retail got this one right. And I think a lot of professional money managers are on the wrong side this year, sold too low, reduced too soon, and didn't realize that roughly the 610 to 580 range, 610 to 480, sorry, was what could be foreseen well before we ever got there, and what, you know, is the likely range. And I'm not saying this range is going to last the rest of this year. We still have more than 50% of the year to go. Too much can happen. But for now, to try to guesstimate or play for new lows coming, if that's the case, you should, if you really believe that, you should be 0% invested in equities. And that generally is a very poor decision to make.
All right, Rick, that's a lot to take in for these markets. Let's move to commodities. Let's talk gold. Since we last chatted, gold was around 3,200. Again, just over a month ago, ran up to 3,500. Now it's right back to 3,200. What's your takeaway just from the trading in the gold market?
Okay, so a few things. First off, coming into today, if I were to ask you what percent of investors do you think are bullish gold, from anywhere from, you know, 0% bullish to 100% bullish, what do you think the answer would, you know, where do you think that is on the scale of things, given what's been a fairly bullish move?
I'm glad you asked, because this is what I've been pointing to. A Bank of America survey, a Gallup poll. Americans, it seems like, have been on this gold trade. The most recent Gallup poll, Americans are favoring gold over stocks long term.
Okay, but what percent? Where do you think we are?
The most recent from the Gallup poll, 23% said the gold is the best long term investment. I assume quite a few people are bullish gold.
So gold has been a phenomenal investment since the year 2000, if we want to just use that as, you know, kind of a good starting point. It has tracked the performance of the S&P, not year to year, but collectively. You've made as much money in gold as you have for the last 25 years being in stocks, which is a phenomenal thing for gold, because gold is supposed to be the hedge. So you'd never expect it to move along with such a massive bull market like we've seen since, you know, March of 2000, which was the breakdown of the tech bubble into the 03 low. Gold has done phenomenally well. As of today, 63% of investors, now this is a short-term poll, not like you were referring to, but 63% are bullish, and that's up 8% from the day before. It topped this year around, let me look, actually I can tell you, because it was well higher than this. Let me see, the high this year in 85% bulls at the peak, which lined up with the April high. So since the April high, you have lower high and lower low. So you have a downward channel, which potentially can be a flag and just a continuation pattern in a bigger, more bullish move. Lows today and yesterday intersected the 50-day moving average. So there is some support there. And you've got resistance now at 3365 or so would be the first resistance level for COMEX gold, for front month gold, which I assume it would be June gold. And if we take out this 50-day moving average, then we open the door for a move that can get to, I don't know, I'll call it, as in a worst case scenario, probably 2850 or so, something like that. I lightened some gold a little too early this year. At 2700, I put it back on at 20, where was it? I think 2850. And I'm still holding the bulk of it. And it's been a great long-term investment. It's held up well with the dollar, even when the dollar went up, it held up well. And when the dollar came off, gold actually has come off with the dollar coming off. It's been more kind of risk on, risk off with stocks as they moved. And which is not what you typically would see. But, you know, yesterday made the low of the move when stocks pretty much made the high of the move. So they have been going, they're back and going opposite direction. Long term, the targets for gold, I've got something right near 3750 and then 4050. And that's where I'd be apt to again reduce my gold holdings.
So again, this gold market, it has been strong. What is your takeaway though from all these surveys that we're seeing? Just how on board it seems like investors have been in gold, and also considering all the bank forecasts, analyst forecasts that have almost been chasing this price higher. Many forecasts now say that gold will be this year, next year, over $3,000, even higher than that.
Well, look, we're over it now, so that's just saying we'll be flat, that it'll hold up. I think what the more important question now is, can gold keep doing what it's done for these years? Is this still a long-term hold where gold will increase value over time? And my guess is it probably can still make its way higher, but from where we are, you could be as much as close to a 50-50 risk to reward. So if you first buy gold now, let's just say round numbers, $3,200 an ounce, your downside risk before you find what should be longer term support is equal to, if not even slightly more than what the upside target is to get to 4,050. And right now, I don't have anything above 4,050 as a meaningful target. So I think it may be a hold, and I'm going to hold mine, and I would probably buy some more if we got down to some of the levels I mentioned. And it sells off 10% or more. But from in here now, I'm kind of this, I can't buy gold at $3,200 an ounce now and just think that I'm going to get away with it simply because of the momentum that we've seen the last few years to the upside. Like most markets, you have to buy when there's blood in the streets. And gold, gave plenty of times that that has occurred, even back to December of 2015 is when I put on the bulk of my gold longs. So I wasn't really involved in gold before that, but that's when I started buying gold. And that's when we had broken down. We had come from an all-time high of just shy of, I think it was maybe 1850 an ounce or something like that. And we got down to 1100 or so an ounce. That's when I first started buying. And this is what I've done for over 40 years on Wall Street, and why I have the clients I do is being able to identify counter trend, the end of a trend before it's obvious to everyone else, so that you can get on board and then let everybody else do the work for you by pushing things higher that you're already into, and you don't have to chase something that's moving higher. Because once you start doing that, your risk reward changes dramatically. Think about this. Let's just make up stock. XYZ is trading at $100 a share. And let's say now it sells down to 80. And you have support between 78 and 82. So you're kind of into a decent support range. But the stock's down 20% and everybody's saying you're in a bear market. If you pay 80, and if it gets down to, let's say, 77, it's broken that important support. So you take a loss, but it's calculated risk. That's a much better buy, in my eyes, than paying 88, saying, oh, look, it held support at 80. It's moving higher. It's trending upward now. Let's buy it at 88. Because if you pay 88, where do you stop yourself out? There's nowhere to stop yourself out until it takes out the recent low. So, from a risk reward point of view, what I do and what I get my clients to do is to buy stuff that looks like crap, but there's a real good reason at the time and place to buy what we're buying. And then we do the same thing on the upside. We sell stuff. How is it that 6 months before we ever got there, I told you and your listeners that if spiders ever got to 609, you want to materially reduce your equity holdings. It's because I could see in advance where there was very good chance that the market was not going to be able to take that level out with any oomph. And that gave people months of advance warning to shift a portfolio and do what they needed to do. A person who came out in February and said, "Oh, sell the spiders, they look toppy." How much do you think a professional portfolio manager is going to do or could possibly do? Because somebody, even if they perfectly timed it to the day that made the all-time high, how much do you think they're going to do, and how much do you think they can shift a portfolio? When you're a professional, it's different for an individual investor, but when you're running a mutual fund, let's say, with billions and billions of dollars, you can't just say, "Oh, today I'm going to sell the S&P." You need weeks and months of time to make that happen, to materially shift, because the amount of shares they hold in a name are huge. They can't just say, "Oh, dear Mr. Broker on Wall Street, dear Goldman Sachs, sell me 50 million shares of Apple today." You think that can be done? It can't. Not without complete disruption in the stock price. They need weeks to flip things. You have to be able to see in advance where numbers and models are going to suggest that you need to do something even before it ever gets there. It's, you have to be able to plan in advance what you're going to do. And a lot of times it's the hardest. I'll give you a stock that I'm still beating myself up on because I had it all lined up before it ever got there. There was a tech stock with a ticker MNDY, Monday. And it happens, it's a software company, it's an Israeli software company that before we ever got there, I told a dear friend of mine, "I'm going to put in a bid at 202, which was about a buck and a half above where all the models suggested it could get to. And if it did, you wanted to be a buyer." And it got down to, I think, 200 and change on the April low. And the night before, I canceled the bid because I had bought some other things. And I said, "Oh, if this thing falls apart." Meanwhile, it was the exact low. And now it's a $300 stock a month later. It's, a 50% move in a month. That was all lined up. And this one I happened to chicken out of only because I had bought a lot of other tech names down there. And of course, it's always hardest buying when the world looks like it's falling apart. But it's that type kind of homework and analysis and things that you need to do beforehand, and you put your orders in. And I'm, very honest with you. I killed it the night before simply because I had bought other names, and I said, "I've just bought a lot of tech, so I killed it." And I'm sorry I did, but the reason I'm saying this is, with the right modeling, you can figure out better than 90% of Wall Street when and where a security is could very likely change direction if you've got to have the right models. And I can tell you the models they use are quite sophisticated and not, generally what people are looking at. And it does allow you to actually create alpha. The one thing that people want on Wall Street is alpha, which translates into outperformance of, a benchmark index. If you're buy and hold, the S&P has just turned positive on the year within what, the last week or so. Look at the difference of your performance versus having sold at 609 and bought some back at 547 and the rest at 482. It's night and day. Now, is it for everyone? Of course not. A lot of people, most people don't have the ability to do that. That's why I have the newsletters I do available. Besides my institutional client base, that's why I created in the notetrader.com. is to give clients, retail clients, access to some of the most sophisticated modeling on the street that I have been using now since 1995. So 30 years. There's very few people on the street who have used these models longer than I have. And it makes a world of difference in how you play this game. Some people, they're very happy to just get the benchmark return because over time, stocks make you money and people say, oh, my broker, you know, I've done very well with my broker. He's made me money. Well, guess what? You could have done the same thing if you just bought spiders and held them for 20 years. He didn't do anything for you. He just perhaps kept you in the market. But if you're a buy and hold person anyway, and all you do is use dips to buy more, you could have done the same thing and saved yourself a boatload of money instead of paying a broker 1% a year. You don't realize how much that 1% adds up to over 40 years. You know, if you're somebody in your 30s and you say, oh, I'm going to use Merrill Lynch, I'm going to use Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, it doesn't matter, right? My broker is doing my UBS broker, da, 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 right? If all they're doing is putting you into a 60-40 or 70-30 split, which you could do yourself using spiders and Qs to get equity exposure and BND and some other ones to and TLT to get bond exposure, you could do the same thing yourself and save yourself an incredible amount of money.
Well, Rick, final comments then. Just a couple more commodities, whichever one you want to take here. Oil. It had a breakdown, recovered. It went to a low of about 56, recovered to about $64 a barrel, has now turned back down. Copper's been range bound. Anything else in the commodity sector before I get you out of here?
I mean, for those, you know, oil has been very tough for traders. The one thing I'll tell you is that the theoretical overhead supply is just huge because even though we have a double bottom at, I don't know, what is it, $55 a barrel, something like that, we've come twice now to about 64. So we have two double bottom, double top, and this is where it broke down from. But just pull up a crude oil chart that goes back, you know, whether it's a daily chart that goes back a couple of years, don't freak, you know, people don't realize oil got to $133 a barrel at the beginning of the Ukraine-Russia war. And it's been down, it's not straight down, but you know, over time, it's just been down since, to the fact that if you go back 1 year, there's over 90% of all people who bought oil are underwater. So that to me just says, unless you're, you know, a day trader, somebody who's trying to play every little nook and cranny, the reality is there is massive overhead supply because people are stuck higher. And if you look at the ETFs for the two key ETFs for, you know, energy, not including XLE, which is just general, but let's say OIH and XOP, oil services holders and energy and gas, these charts, they have bottoms in place, but they have massive overhead supply. I don't think you get anywhere trying to make money in the energy space, at least on the oil side. The one thing I think that there's probably, maybe there'll be one last chance opportunity to play is natural gas. It recently got a double bottom at $3. It peaked at, I don't know, $3.80 or something like that, even over the last week or two. And I think there's one more chance that maybe this thing gets down to, I don't know, $2.80 to $2.50. And that would be kind of the last place and last time I would probably take an attempt to buy natural gas for a potentially bigger move over time. But, you know, the thing about natural gas is if you trade the commodity, if it's in contango, you lose money rolling it each month. So that's no good because you keep buying a higher price contract than what you're selling out of. UNG, the ETF that tracks it, loses the contango and its pricing structure, so that's no good. So you really need to find quality names, that equity names that have more exposure to the natural gas side than, let's say, the oil side. And those are potential candidates to buy. But in general, energy is a horrible sector to invest in for the long term. And basically, you've made, since XLE and these spider ETFs started trading, I think it was in the year 2000, you have made absolutely no money versus the S&P. So it is the only sector to not have gained value. So that's just a parting thought for all of those who love your Exxon and your Chevrons and all that stuff. You make absolutely, you don't make a penny of alpha being in those names. And some of them, you just simply don't make money at all, which makes me think of, here's a final thought. Automobile stocks, generally terrible. So if you go back 100 years and you bought a share of Ford and you adjust for inflation, you're up precisely $0 in 100 years after inflation. There are just certain parts of the market that are not good investments. And generally, energy is not, and car makers are not. And I don't put Tesla in car maker because that's really a technology firm and an AI firm. It just happens to bring it to the public through a car, but that's not what they really are.
So fascinating, Rick. Thank you as always for your time. I take in a lot from these conversations, and we cover a lot in these conversations. Wide range of markets here, and really that takeaway of what 2025 could be for markets, a pause in trends, and then what the next trend might be. Who knows what that is, but we chat on a monthly basis, and I will definitely be getting updates from you when we turn the calendar over into June. Again, if you want to follow along with Rick, especially on that retail individual side of things, visit the In the Know Trader, which I will link to in the show notes. Rick, thanks for your time on this weekend show. Greatly appreciate it.
Corey, thanks for having me.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin and Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.